Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Thursday, the 11th of June. Our main stories: the brother of George Floyd has called on the US Congress to make sure he didn't die in vain. A British scientist says the UK could have halved its coronavirus deaths if the government had brought in lockdown a week earlier. And relatives of COVID-19 victims in Italy are seeking justice over the handling of the pandemic. Also in the podcast:
we used to cook rice, rotis and vegetables before the lockdown. Our children ate well. Now they remain hungry because we have no money and no work.
The millions of families in India battling starvation because of the virus. And a lost Banksy paying homage to the Paris terror attack victims has resurfaced in another country. Eric Garner, Philando Castile, Michael Brown, just some of the African Americans killed at the hands of US police in recent years. Each death has prompted calls for change, but to no avail. So could the killing of George Floyd, who is filmed suffocating under the knee of a police officer, actually lead to substantial reform? That's the hope of George Floyd's brother, Philonis, testifying at a hearing in the US Congress on Wednesday.
I'm tired. I'm tired of pain. Pain you feel when you watch something like that. When you watch your big brother, who you looked up to for your whole life, die begging for his mom. I'm here to ask you to make it stop. Stop the pain. Stop us from being tired. George called for help and he was ignored. Please listen to the call I'm making to you now, to the calls of our family and the calls ringing out the streets across the world. People of all backgrounds, genders and races have come together to demand change.
Philonis Floyd at a hearing into policing practices. The chief of police in Minneapolis, where George Floyd was killed, has meanwhile announced his own plans for reform. Madaria Arredondo said he'd bring in an early warning system to tackle police misconduct.
Race is inextricably a part of the American policing system. We will never evolve in this profession if we do not address it head on. Communities of color have paid the heaviest of costs, and that is with their lives. And our children must be safeguarded from ever having to contribute to the horrific and shameful chapter of this country's history. My plan will focus on imperative and respected community collaboration with an emphasis on the science of justice.
In Washington, Democrats have introduced legislation on police reform, which the House of Representatives Judiciary Committee is considering. But are we likely to see real change? Our Washington correspondent is Gary O'Donoghue.
Listening to both sides, the Democrats and the Republicans today, on the committee at least, you'd be, on the face of it, pretty hopeful, because there's been, sure, lots of empathy. All the words are in the right order. Both sides have said they want reform and change, and this is a kind of seminal moment and all that. But I would stress that I think we've been here before with these killings by the police of black men and women, and not much has changed subsequently. So I think, you know, there are differences with this case. It did spark a nationwide protest movement, if you like, which hasn't always been the case previously. This one was particularly, I mean, they're all brutal. This one was particularly brutal, as you know, from the detail. So we'll see. The Democrats have got a bunch of proposals on the table. The Republicans don't like all of them by any means. But there was one very hard-line Republican who's pretty partisan most of the time on this committee, saying that the Democrats can expect cooperation from their Republican counterparts.
Gary O'Donoghue in Washington. Although many of the protests over the death of George Floyd were peaceful, there was some looting. Last week in New York City, big-name stores were targeted in Manhattan. Over in the Bronx, though, it was small businesses owned by people of colour that were destroyed, as Laura Trevelyan reports.
The subway trains run overhead. Jessica Betancourt shows me the steel shutters that were supposed to protect her optician store in the Bronx. Instead, looters used a crowbar to smash their way in. Security cameras captured the devastation as men in masks stole eyewear and snatched $13,000 from the safe. Jessica is reeling at what happened hours after the peaceful protests against George Floyd's killing.
It's hurtful because you think about the peaceful protests and George Floyd, and they're destroying his memory. And one thing doesn't have to do with the other. As small businesses, we're getting destroyed because it's like they have an opportunity. This is their opportunity to destroy our community.
So this week, there's hammering and drilling as store owners in the Bronx rebuild. They'd hope to be reopening. New York City is finally easing the coronavirus lockdown.
That wasn't a march gone left. It wasn't a protest gone wrong.
The Bronx Borough President Ruben Diaz Jr. has spent years encouraging people of color to invest in this neighborhood and own their own businesses. He has this message for the looters.
You can't say no justice, no peace. You can't march against systemic racism and then take shots and break windows and loot the stores that are owned by minorities that are addressing inherently systemic racism.
Jessica Betancourt cried when she saw the damage done to her optician store, the shattered glass everywhere. But she wants to serve this neighborhood.
Are you hopeful that you can move on from this? We cannot forget it. It's not something that you can just erase and forget and just move on. Sometimes there's a small fear of what's going to happen, but we're going to move on. And we're going to open the doors and we're going to service our patients just the way we did a year ago when we opened. And just be positive.
So many in the Bronx are used to hardship and poverty. Now they're dealing with the aftermath of chaos on the streets and a pandemic which has laid bare the fault lines of race and poverty in American society.
Laura Trevelyan reporting from the Bronx. The jihadist group Al-Qaeda is trying to capitalise on the unrest in the US, presenting itself as a champion of the oppressed. Our security correspondent Frank Gardner has the details.
For months, Western intelligence chiefs have been warning that Al-Qaeda has not gone away, it is simply waiting for opportunities. Now the fugitive jihadist group, once led by Osama bin Laden, is trying to make common cause with those in the US protesting against police brutality and racial discrimination. The most recent issue of its online magazine called One Ummah features an image of George Floyd in the last moments before his death, as well as protesters burning a US flag. Its editorial predicts a civil war and the breakdown of US society, while appealing to Americans to convert to Islam and shun the current political system.
Frank Gardner. Slavery in the United States was abolished more than 150 years ago, but with the recent Black Lives Matter protests, the idea of reparations has been gaining traction, with some saying that billions of dollars in damages should now be paid to the descendants of African-American slaves. But is that fair? That's a question Ed Butler put to Bob Johnson, founder of Black Entertainment Television and RLJ Technologies, and the first African-American billionaire.
First of all, the answer is yes. You're giving money to their descendants who, were it not for slavery and the other economic injustices inflicted upon their children and grandchildren and so on, they would not be living in a country that preaches equal justice, but has never lived up to that purpose and goal in terms of the treatment of African Americans. There are people living in Germany today who had absolutely nothing to do with the Nazi horror, who are today paying reparations to the Jews of Germany and other Jews.
You've put a number on this of $14 trillion, haven't you?
What I did was to say, what is the average net worth of a white household in the United States, the medium wealth of a white household in this country? It came to approximately $350,000. So to bring 40 million descendants of slaves up to that level so there's true equality, Multiply that number by 40 million, 40 million times the $350,000 per African American. That gets you to 14 trillion approximately. Under my proposal, it would commence the moment the program was implemented, and 30 years hence, after that, it would sunset. So this is a 30-year repayment. It's approximately $11,000 or so a year per African-American descendant of slaves.
It would be a bonanza for those people, wouldn't it? I mean, that's two-thirds of the current US GDP, $14 trillion, spread over 30 years. I mean, 20% of the population. It's a gigantic sum.
And it wouldn't be a bonanza. It would be damages owed to them for past programs that denied them the same rights as white citizens. And just think about this. If someone broke into your home and stole things out of there, locked you up in the kitchen while they ransacked your house, took everything that you held dear, the government would say, Ed, you're entitled to damages for everything that was stolen from you. And what you would do with that, probably, you would restore all of the things that would deprive you. You would, if you were planning to send your kids to college because you had some money in a safe in your home, you would take that money and still send your children off to college. That's what African Americans would do with what is owed to them as an atonement for the past sins.
Bob Johnson talking to the BBC's Ed Butler. Here in Britain, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson has announced a further easing of coronavirus restrictions, but the changes have been overshadowed by a claim from a leading scientist that the government could have cut the death toll in half if it had imposed the lockdown a week earlier. Professor Neil Ferguson, who resigned from the government's advisory group last month after breaking social distancing rules, was speaking to the House of Commons Science Committee.
The epidemic was doubling every 3 to 4 days before lockdown interventions were introduced. So had we introduced lockdown measures a week earlier, we would have reduced the final death toll by at least a half.
So did Boris Johnson regret not locking down the country earlier? Our political correspondent Rob Watson told me more.
To set this in context, Neil Ferguson was pretty much the most important modeller for the government. So what he says is immensely important, also in the context of the UK having the highest death toll in Europe. So truly a grim intervention. But Mr. Johnson and the two senior scientists who he was flanked by insisted that it was just too early to say. So absolutely no apology, no sense of saying that he would have done things differently. But I think it was incredibly telling that he was pressed not just by one a journalist, but one after another after another. And of course, that comes on top of more bad news for the government. The forecast from the OECD that Britain was likely to come out of the coronavirus worse than any of the advanced G7 countries.
Meanwhile, at that news conference, Boris Johnson announced some changes to the lockdown and some easing. Let's have a listen to what he said.
From this weekend, we will allow single adult households or single parents with children under 18 to form a support bubble with one other household.
OK, so a relaxation there, Rob, but plenty of discussion about the speed of relaxing restrictions and criticism that children may not get back to school for 6 months.
Absolutely. So you have this sort of situation where as of next week, it's possible for a child to go and see a camel in a zoo, but not to go to the classroom, which has attracted all sorts of derision towards the government. But I think I'd set out the government's problem more broadly, and that is it's one thing to shut down in the face of a pandemic. It's quite another thing to reopen. A country, and what the government has found itself in is a sort of pincer movement, if you like, with many in the country thinking we've got to unlock much further, much faster, much quicker, otherwise the economy was really going to suffer even more than it is. But you also have people on the other sort of spectrum saying it's way too early to be talking about every single child going back to school. And because the opinion polls suggest that many ordinary people are somewhat losing faith in the government's handling of this crisis, and because there's certainly unease in Mr. Johnson's own Conservative Party, you can see this is an immensely tricky moment for the Prime Minister and his government.
Rob Watson. Still to come in the podcast.
About 15 metres from me, just standing there. It was really angelic, just standing.
After an autism-friendly search, rescuers find a boy lost in the Australian bush for 2 days. The relatives of some COVID victims in Italy are taking legal action over how the pandemic was handled. The complaint was submitted in the northern city of Bergamo, one of the worst-hit parts of the country. It comes as the Italian Prime Minister prepares to be questioned by prosecutors about the outbreak. Our Europe regional editor Danny Eberhard told me about the family's legal case.
They're looking for, they say, truth and justice. They're not looking for compensation. Basically, they're trying to denounce things that have gone wrong. And they've come up with a series of heartbreaking personal stories about the sort of things that happened to relatives of theirs that died. And there was a woman, Christina Longini, she's a pharmacist, and she described basically how her father, who's in his 60s, had problems getting admitted to hospital. And then when they had tried to admit him into hospital, there wasn't a bed. So the family was told that they had to look for their own intensive care bed, which they couldn't find. When they finally got him into a hospital, they didn't inform the family that he'd died. This woman, Miss Longini, was given a bag of his belongings and contaminated clothes in a bin liner. He was then taken away from Bergamo in an army truck, his body, and they didn't even find out where he was cremated until they got a bill for it. You know, some really appalling tales. What they're looking for, they're not looking to aim this litigation or possible litigation at health workers. They're looking at the decision makers, basically people in leadership positions. Did they do enough to lock areas down in time? Were there other reasons to suspect criminal negligence? So that's the basis of the complaints.
Danny Eberhard. The lockdown in India hit daily wage earners there particularly hard. They were given just a few hours notice and many were left without work or accommodation. Now, millions of them are struggling to feed their families. And a new study by Johns Hopkins University in the US says nearly 300,000 children could die from malnutrition in India over the next 6 months. Divya Arya has this report.
I'm in this vast open ground near a slum outside the capital, Delhi, where two volunteers have come to distribute food packets. But as soon as they started, they were surrounded by scores of children. Hunger has always been an issue in low-income communities, but this desperation is new. These children's families have no jobs anymore, so it feels like a fight for survival. A few kilometers away in a colony lined with bungalows is a small tent pitched on an empty plot. Shiva, just 1 month old, lives here with his six siblings. His parents are construction workers and rely on daily wages to buy food. Like millions of others, Phoolmati Devi and her husband lost work after the government announced a lockdown in March.
We used to cook rice, rotis and vegetables before the lockdown. Our children ate well. Now they remain hungry because we have no money and no work.
Apart from Shiva, two sisters are under 5 years, the age when children are most vulnerable to severe malnutrition. India is already the worst in the world, with 1 in 5 children affected. Now studies suggest that might have become much worse. Harriet Torles is the regional head of nutrition at UNICEF.
So this is almost the perfect storm for malnutrition in this region, with a very vulnerable population, with declining quality and quantity of diets, and without the access to the essential services that children need.
For more than 45 years, the Indian government has run a child development scheme to provide essential vitamins and nutrients to children up to the age of 6 through centres known as the Anganwadis. But during the coronavirus lockdown, most of the more than 1 million Anganwadi centres were shut down. Now some of them are trying to home deliver a much smaller quantity of food supplements at a time when they're most critical for young children's development. Now it's ordinary citizens who have stepped up, like Neelesh Singh, who has been cooking food with the help of his family and funds raised through his NGO. He has been distributing one hot meal a day to 500 children since the past 2 months. But that's hardly enough.
I can provide one or two meals, but children need breakfast, lunch and dinner. They're not getting the nutrition they need.
Despite a surge in coronavirus cases, the lockdown is easing. The government has a huge dilemma: how to stop the deadly spread of the disease and protect the most vulnerable, particularly children, from hunger and even starvation.
Divya Arya reporting from Delhi. An Australian boy missing for two nights on a mountainside in near freezing conditions has been rescued by a volunteer. Will Callahan is 14, has autism and doesn't speak. He disappeared while on a camping trip near Melbourne with his dad and brother. Jonathan Savage has the details.
Miracle. The headline on Thursday's Herald Sun newspaper uses the word on everyone's lips. 400 police officers and volunteers have been combing Mount Disappointment since the alarm was raised on Monday. With temperatures near freezing both nights, hopes of finding Will alive were fading. Because of his autism, Will wouldn't react well to loud noises, so police had been playing the theme tune to his favourite TV show, Thomas the Tank Engine. Eventually, Will was found by volunteer Ben Gibbs. He spoke to ABC News.
Just wandering through the bush. It was quite thick, so just breaking my way through it. And then he was just like about 15 metres from me, just standing there. He was really angelic, just standing and looking, so, you know. I heard that he liked Thomas the Tank, and so I just sort of talked to him about Diesel and stuff like that. Birdie and said, have you seen Diesel? You know, so stuff like that.
Ben gave Will some chocolate, put socks on his naked feet and summoned support. Aside from a few cuts and scrapes, the teenager is said to be relatively fine. When she saw her son again, Penny Callahan couldn't believe her eyes. She thanked the people who'd searched for him.
Thank you, everyone. I'm so grateful. You're all amazing. What an amazing community. So, what more can I say? I want to be with my boy.
Mount Disappointment is named for the emotion felt by explorers unable to see nearby Port Phillip Bay from its summit. But it's special to the Callahan family. They've scattered the ashes of grandparents there. It's where family pets have been laid to rest. For the Callahans, it's been a place of remembrance. They'll now remember it for so much more.
Jonathan Savage. A work thought to be by the graffiti artist Banksy has been found on a farm in central Italy after being stolen from the Bataclan Theatre in Paris last year. The mural of a young woman looking sad, painted on an emergency exit door, was a tribute to the victims of the terror attack in the French capital in 2015. Here's our Rome correspondent, Mark Lowen.
The image of a woman, her head veiled and bowed in a gesture of sadness, was stenciled in white on a black door at the Bataclan. The venue described it as a symbol of remembrance belonging to all. It was cut away by thieves in January 2019, just over 3 years after Islamic State militants killed 90 people at the Paris Concert Hall and dozens more across the city. Now, in a joint operation by French and Italian police, it's been found at an abandoned farmhouse in Abruzzo in central Italy. The mural was one of eight works in Paris, apparently painted in 2018 by the British graffiti artist, whose identity remains unknown. Once he shared them, thieves struck fast. Banksy himself hasn't yet reacted to this find, but perhaps his response will pop up on a wall the next time the street artist strikes.
Mark Lowen. Now to some much older art. A tiny bird statuette, carved from burnt bone and around the same size as a coin, has been found in China. It's the earliest East Asian artwork ever discovered. Our reporter Beth Timmins has the details.
The sculpture, discovered by an international team of archaeologists at Lingjing in China, depicts a bird on a pedestal with deliberate marks where the creature's eyes and bill would be. It's between 13,000 and 13,800 years old, pushing back the earliest known date of East Asian animal sculpture by more than eight millennia. Much older artefacts have been discovered in Europe, with mammoth ivory figures from the Swabian Jura region of Germany believed to be more than 40,000 years old. But far less is known about the emergence of sculpture in other parts of the world. The researchers say this tiny bird could be the missing link, tracing the origin of Chinese statuary art back to the Paleolithic. Scans revealed that the ancient sculptor used complex carving techniques, abrading, gouging and incising with stone tools. They think the bird's oversized tail was made to balance the figurine and that these stylistic clues indicate it may belong to an entirely original artistic tradition, unconnected to other ancient styles found in Europe or Siberia.
Beth Timmins. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on the podcast or anything in it, email globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.